Hello and welcome to Fidelity Connects by Fidelity Investments Canada, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. Today, we welcome back portfolio manager Bruce McDonald. For Canadian investors, Bruce manages Fidelity Far East Fund. In today's podcast, Bruce discusses his outlook for the Asian equity markets and where opportunities can be found overseas. With host Pamela Ritchie, Bruce also dives deeper into government policies, specific sectors and trends, and his overall investment philosophy. Today's podcast was recorded on November 25th, 2020. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
Bruce, who normally works on the ground in Hong Kong, is joining us today from the UK, where, fun fact, he served as an aerospace engineer for Westland Helicopters, an officer in the Royal Navy. Bruce is at the helm of the Far East Fund, which has been around at Fidelity since 1991. Bruce, welcome back. Great to see you again.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
It's great to catch up with you. It's been a few months. I think we were sort of end of the summer last time we spoke with you. Bring us up to date on what we're all talking about, which is the presence of a vaccine light at the end of the tunnel in the marketplace. We are seeing what it's doing. What does it mean to land in China on a plane at a Chinese airport? What's the testing protocol? What ultimately will be the vaccine protocol? You've done this. Bring us up to date on what we might be doing at some point.
Yeah, it is interesting and it is very dynamic. I've already done two quarantines this year. I've got a third one coming up just after Christmas. And the protocol in Hong Kong is the same as in China, where you are tested at the airport, you're tagged, you have a app put on your smartphone. You cannot move out of wherever you're quarantining. And for me, it has to be a hotel room now. And in China, it's a hotel room. You cannot come out of there for 2 weeks. And you're tested again 10 days later to make sure you're clear. At that point, you're allowed out. And only at that point. And a lot of the countries in the region are paranoid about importing cases. So for instance, China has very few cases that are not imported. Hong Kong also has very few, but it is seeing an increase. Same in Singapore, same in the Korea as well. So they've managed to close their economies down by putting the strict quarantine in, and the vaccine hopefully will allow some of this restriction to limit or to be taken away. And the challenge is, and I think, you know, for a lot of regions, you know, in China, getting the vaccine out across the country, I think, would be quite straightforward, given that they've got the infrastructure. But in some of the other regions within Asia, for instance, Indonesia or Philippines, where they're more physically constrained, they maybe don't have the necessary infrastructure there to do it, it might be more challenging. So we're going to see different paces of how the vaccines will be implemented and how quickly can get them across the bulk of the population.
It's interesting. There are attempts to create bubbles, to create sort of travel hubs between, I know Japan and China, I think, have announced in the last couple of days that they're getting much closer to sort of business travel mobility. Bring us up to date on where some of the most optimistic looking bubbles, travel bubbles, might be.
Yeah, and so the probably the most optimistic one I have seen recently was Hong Kong, Singapore, Hong Kong, the southern provinces of China as well. The problem is that Hong Kong has seen an increase in cases recently, so I don't know how significant that has. In absolute numbers, it's a small amount, but as a percentage change on the absolute number, it's a significant number. I don't know how that changes where we are, because I said this is dynamic and things are moving a lot. The Chinese do not, I said already, they do not have many cases within China, so they do not want to open up a travel bubble where they could cause challenges for them. So they're very strict. I know Hong Kong government have been pushing China to open up that border because Hong Kong is really struggling without any flow of people, tourists or anything through the border into Hong Kong. And I think the same for a lot of regions, but China are being very strict. If you can't, show that we're not importing cases, we're not going to open up without a quarantine.
You know, we heard the news of the Chinese vaccine that's now seeking authorization to go into sort of the next phase and so on to get it moving along. There's lots of discussions about who it will be shared with from China and so on. But as you mentioned to me off air, there's actually so few cases in China that they can't even really do the next version of testing in China. Is that right?
Yes, and they're having to go into countries like the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, other countries to test the drug. They're inoculating Chinese citizens who work abroad, and there's been cases where there's been a COVID in one of the offices where Chinese workers have been inoculated abroad, and Chinese workers who were vaccinated didn't catch COVID. So they're trying to get the data as much as they can. But and it's an interesting kind of regional dynamic that China are actually having to go to other countries, emerging countries, and ask for their permission to test the drug. I would assume on the basis that China will give them as much vaccine as they want when it becomes available. And you know, that creates a whole sort of dynamic between the West and China, who's vaccine and who has the most power in this power play that we're seeing played out in so many levels.
And it's just so vastly different, the picture that you painted for us in terms of the controls and how it's been managed and how effectively created very, very few cases, where we have rising cases in almost every other part of the world. I mean, it's such a starkly different picture. How different is the investing landscape because of the virus? I mean, the virus is still the biggest thing in markets at this point. I mean, yeah. I'll ask you if you agree with that. But with that vastly different situation on the virus, how are you looking at Chinese equities and Asian equities in a different way? We'll bring in the trading discussion in a minute, but just first of all, your other.
Yeah, for me, it's not, COVID has obviously been significant, but it's not actually the number of cases, which is the challenge for me. It's how the developed countries have had to deal with COVID. And so if you think about what happened post the GFC, you know, there was the kind of normal debt revulsion you have post the recession. So, but that was short circulated by central banks, whose policies was to flood the system with money and cut interest rates to zero, or effectively zero. And that's had two big impacts that make Asia look a much more attractive investment universe. The first impact is that the combined stimulus we've seen in these regions is unprecedented in post-war era. It's 35% of GDP. And if you look at developed markets, it's about 8% of GDP. If you look at Asia, ex-Japan and Japan, it's about 2%, and in China, it's about 4%. So it's a much less of an impact. And the balance sheets of the developed countries, and I'm talking to you from the UK, and we've just had the Chancellor speak today about the level of unemployment and what we're going to have to do to address the balance sheet issues that we've got here. It's a generational issue. My children and grandchildren are going to have to cope with this. That's the first reason. The second one is that I think the casualty of low interest rates is that many companies are kept alive. They're zombie companies. And by that, I mean, zombie companies are those that basically make enough capital to service their debt, but they never repay their debt. And the banks don't call the debt in because they don't want to put the bad debt on their balance sheets. That has got a huge impact. And the impact is that is capital that's employed that is not efficient. It's not going to generate growth. And the number of zombie companies has doubled in the developed markets since 2007. So you've got a huge amount of capital sitting there, which is not going to generate growth. So there are two reasons why I think developed market growth is going to be materially lower than Asian growth. And that's why, you know, I'm excited about the opportunities we have in Asia relative to developed markets. We're not carrying that legacy, and we're not carrying that kind of dead weight of the zombie companies.
And we mentioned in the introduction, you know, what indices are up over the course of the last sort of year to date in across various markets. But talk to us about some key sort of five key Chinese stocks, for instance, what they have done, what they contribute to these large jumps, and what else is out there for the offering that you look at as well.
Yeah, I mean, this has been I was trying to think, there has been a year like this, and I can't remember which year it was, where if you take out, what you implied was, if you take out five companies, and they are Alibaba, Tencent, Meituan, TSMC, and JD.com, the Asian markets are up 2.5%. If you include them, they're up 13.5%. Exclude them, the market's only up 2.5%. Include them, the markets are up 13.5%. They have driven the market this year. And the scale of dispersion and dislocation is enormous. But that's because these are the obvious beneficiaries of lockdown and people staying at home and not wanting to go out and socially distance. I mean, I've done all my Christmas shopping on Amazon, you know, and as many people will do, or other platforms that are out there, I guess. But if you look forward, look at the 21 consensus earnings per share growth for the region. You've got, I think, a huge opportunity in the region to generate alpha. Active managers, I've got, 21 is going to be a great year for active managers. You can really differentiate yourself because of the divergence and dislocations that are in the market today will not be there at the end of 21. And you can't just hide in five stocks and, you know, generate performance. You've got to go looking for them. And they're not, and I don't believe that the vaccine related plays are the way to do it. You have to be dig deeper than that and try and find which of the companies where the greatest opportunities relative to the valuation are.
So layer on top for us then this regional comprehensive economic partnership, which essentially is a new trading pact, somewhat in its infancy, just got signed about 10 days ago by most nations in Asia to work together in trade. Some will say it's a bit toothless because it's sort of new. It doesn't have a whole lot of rules and regulations and so on. But what is it going to couch, or what sort of impact will it have to grow out of this period with a new partnership for Asian countries?
I think it's got a huge impact. And you said in the introduction, it's, you know, 30% of global GDP in trade. It's very significant. It's the first time that China, Japan, South Korea have all been covered by the same multilateral pact. And so there's always been pacts, but this is the first time it's so broad. And I think, you know, the highest level is likely to drive investment and trade across Asia in the mid and long term. And again, what you've alluded to, we don't know, that the details have got to be thrashed out on this in terms of, you know, where we're going with this. But you can see significant amount of change in the investment universe, because essentially what this covers is trade and services, market access, intellectual property rights, government procurement. So there are lots of factors here which I think will be which will change. And, you know, the kind of proportion of goods covered by this for a range across the different regions. Singapore is 100%, China is about 86%. Japan, it's kind of 90%. South Korea, it's 92%. There's a huge amount of goods covered from, and so it has significant impact. And I think the beneficiaries likely in China are going to be commodity suppliers of commodity to China, things like high-end components, cosmetics from Japan and Korea. And in China, it's likely to, well, the Chinese companies likely to see textiles, apparel, home appliances, and also inter-regional trade as we see much more trade. So I think it's going to be significant, but it's come at a time where US-China trade is headline grabbing every day. You've also got China having arguments with Australia. So, you know, how relevant, how significant could it be when you've got the scale of uncertainty at the moment? But I think it will be significant. We just need time for it to put the flesh on the bones.
That's fascinating. So maybe that's why we're not hearing much about it. I mean, it's no. Actually, it got signed and there's not a whole lot of commentary, but maybe as you say, no. There's just some other things going on. Later on top, if you can, we're sort of building a bit of a melty story structure here, but does it fit with Belt and Road, this new trading partnership? I mean, to what extent does it fit with the initiatives that were infrastructure-based, basically?
I think it fits to a degree. If you think, so I'm going to take a slight step back. If you think about what China did post the global financial crisis, it invested in infrastructure, it invested in basic services, and it built up all this capacity, and it needed something to do with that capacity. Once it had built the roads, it built everything, it started to export that to build its influence in regions, and that's what Belt and Road to me has been. What one of the big kind of investment thesis in China is there are two things. There's the kind of effectively the empty nesters, because there's a huge change in the profile of demand in China because of empty nesters. The second one is the self-sufficiency of their supply chain. So I think what this is part of that self-sufficiency of the supply chain. So they're starting to say, okay, we've got now high-end products, we want to start moving them out. We've built our supply chain and we want to start exporting that, and we want to have the trade agreements to allow us to do that.
I want to go through some, you've done such a wonderful job of talking about some of the regional players, well, within the region, but some of the countries and so on. Some of the sectors, one of the questions coming in, explain, please, if you would, the opportunities around China's automobile sector, particularly electric vehicles. Lots of discussion that, you know, perhaps the exports of either European cars or North American cars to China or you know, plants there won't be as useful going forward. What do you hear about that?
Yeah, this is an area we've spent a lot of time working on, because essentially the way I always argue, the way to make money in China is to follow the government's money. And what I mean is, where the government are investing is where you want to be. The government have basically identified certain segments, sectors where they want to invest. Semiconductors are one, but that's another. Answering your question specifically, electric vehicles is where they know they can leapfrog the West and get ahead of the West. There's no point trying to compete with a Mercedes or a BMW or a Volkswagen brand. They you can see from Tesla that the brand is not actually that important. It's about the technology, and it's about the factors which consumers, particularly in China, when they're choosing an EV vehicle, are very different to when you're choosing they want to have a brand parked outside or driving to show off their wealth. And so this gives China a chance to effectively jump right ahead of all the Western automobile makers. And that's why China is investing so much money into this industry, every part of the supply chain. The challenge for us as investors is the Wild West out there. And it's, you know, companies have gone from being almost bankrupt to being worth billions, you know, in literally a four or five week period. And where in the supply chain do you add value? But it is there's going to be significant value created there. Right now, it's not clear where the value is going to come, where to be in the supply chain. It's a bit like I kind of think about it. It's a bit like, you know, Tesla is like the Apple. We need to find the highway or the Chinese equivalent. And where is it coming from? And there'll be a lot of fallout, and not everyone there today will be there in the end.
Right. It's really a new beginnings story. The question just about your process. What is the mandate of the Far East Fund? How would you describe your investment style, the purpose of the fund? Can you go into that, please?
Yeah. I mean, the fund, if you think of the benchmark, it's about 80% Greater China, Hong Kong, Taiwan. So it's largely Greater China. Then there's Korea's about another 14-15%, and so the rest of it is ASEAN. And it's the investment universe is hugely broad. So you can go across all of these different regions. But again, Greater China is the largest portion of it. The way that investment process is, I run this fund relatively concentrated, 40 stocks. And what we want to own are what we term in Fidelity the long-term winners. And we want to own these stocks that are going to be the structural winners. So we've owned Alibaba for a long time. We've owned a number of companies for a long time as they just keep compounding. And what we're trying to find are those that are going to, you know, we're not looking about what cycle we're talking, you know, whether it's the auto cycle or whatever, it's the semi cycle. We're looking for what companies are going to give us have the highest earnings power. And that's the companies we want to own and try and buy them at the right opportunity at the right time in the cycle. But it's about owning the kind of the leading company. So, you know, I've not owned two of the companies in that bucket of five those five companies I said this year, because they're not the leaders in the industry. And I think the leaders are going to dominate. And with a low interest rate environment, actually what happens is that the dispersion between the leaders and the second tier expands. And that's not come through yet, but it will come through eventually, being patient and owning the best companies with the best earning power.
So interesting. Okay, let's talk about, this is really the question about evaluating the difficulty of analysis and evaluating companies in China that sometimes have a different accounting standard. How do you look at that? I mean, what do you do with that?
Yeah, that is a constant challenge here. ESG is... obviously, I'm a European. I've been involved in ESG for a long time. It's something, 12, 15 years being involved with ESG. It's something that's embedded in my process. And in China particularly, it's the governance side actually is the biggest challenge. Can you trust the accounts? Can you trust what you're being shown? You know, where does it, you know, that is the biggest challenge. We have a specialist team of experts purely focus on the governance side, and they will go into China and they will go and count how many people are coming out of the shop, or you know, literally that level. We will go and try and figure out if what we're seeing is real, what we're seeing in the accounts is real. It's very difficult, and that's why we tend to limit our exposures for that reason and try and find the companies where we have the highest conviction, because there are kind of ground-based, feet on the ground work is showing that. And obviously it's more challenging right now, but there was, you know, a situation where there's a company coming out to IPO, and we had people in China go and check out, you know, what they're saying to what actually is coming through the stores, because we're not sure it matches up. And you know, that's the level of kind of detail we're going to before we put capital to work in these markets.
Anything to say on sort of what we've talked a lot about, the five leaders that you mentioned in the equity market there, and perhaps a chance for some of the other things through normalization to catch fire, and you're looking in that area a lot. It's a bit like the discussion of value versus growth that we hear a lot about. Is that an adequate comparison for you or not really?
No, I don't look at it value growth, because I think the problem is you've got so many structural drivers out there that the value growth discussion kind of breaks down slightly. And I think, you know, things like COVID, technology changes because of work from home and people working in different ways, climate change, ESG, all these factors mean that value, traditional kind of value and cyclicality stocks are just not, I don't think that they're going to work. So you have to be more, has to be more nuanced in that respect. It's, you know, it's trying to find companies where the earnings growth is not reflected in the valuation of the company. And that sounds like an easy thing to do. It's actually when you're dealing with so much uncertainty, it's challenging, because, and that's why time helps Fidelity because we're looking out 5 years. So I can take a view and say, okay, I know this stock is going to be up, its earnings are going to be here and the market's going to put a higher multiple on it over this time. I can't tell you, if I'm thinking of a graph, what the x-axis time frame is going to be. Is it 6 months? Is it 12 months? But I know it's going to happen. And I can do that with confidence, and I can use our time duration to our advantage.
Anything to say on currency? We discuss, you know, the idea that the US dollar is on a weakening sort of trend. That makes it better for other currencies in a lot of cases. We also know the PBOC has been working with a digital currency rollout. What's your sort of comment on either exposure through some of the currencies or just your thoughts on the US dollar?
I think it's going to be, it's definitely a factor. Particularly, I always think, I never think currency, I'm always thinking stock specifics, and currency is just another factor, but you can't invest in the South Asian economies without understanding, having a view on the currency, because you can effectively make a lot of gains and lose all of the conversion from local currency to US dollar. But I think the South Asian economies have been hit materially worse. So Thailand, Indonesia, the Philippines, than they should have because of currency effects this year. Also because those economies are much more tourist related, or have been hit heavier by. I think as a normalization and a currency benefit as the US dollar weakens, I think they will be very strong markets for Alpha. And I don't know if it will be on 21 or it's going to be over the next 18, 24 months.
Bruce McDonald, I feel like we've only got the tip of the iceberg here. There's so much more to discuss and to go into. Thank you for joining us today. I hope we'll see you again soon.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. For more information on future live webcasts, please visit fidelity.ca. Don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter and subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice.